So thank you for all your questions. There were a lot. I don't know that I'll get to all of them this evening. But if I do miss one that's totally burning for you, you could try and catch me tomorrow before we leave. So just the first few, I grouped them generally into loose themes. The first few are about insight meditation practice here on retreat. And there was a question about seeing patterns when sitting with the eyes closed, different kinds of patterns, and there was some description of colors and shapes and textures. And then the person said they thought they were probably just a byproduct of attention and unimportant, but wanted to check. So yeah, these kind of visual effects often do come as the samadhi or the concentration starts to get just a little stronger. And that stilling of the mind can be associated in the beginning with different kinds of visual effects. So the colors and patterns that were described, sometimes different types of light. And the key with all of these experiences, we could call them meditation phenomena, is just to notice our relationship to them. To notice whether there's even a slight trace of clinging or resisting or taking ownership of them in any way. So for example, clinging might show up as feeling excited that finally something new and a little bit more interesting is happening. And then wanting to continue and trying to enhance and deepen it, which of course usually makes it go away completely. And then the other, the resistance, can show up as, oh, this is weird, I'm not sure about this, make it go away, which of course makes it stick around for longer. So in some ways, with all of these different meditation phenomena, we can think of them as testing the strength of our equanimity, testing our capacity to be with just what is, without identifying it, without making it into any kind of story about what it might mean or not mean.
Did more than one person pose that question?
That comes up in meetings very often.
Okay. Oh, yes. I just wasn't aware of that, that's all.
Yeah, yeah, okay, the meetings are one-on-one. So.
Right, okay.
But yeah, and not a, you know, it's common on every retreat, yeah. So then there are some questions about working with difficult situations from life. To actively invite them in or wait until they arise? And what if they don't naturally arise? Well, and then there was another one about working with pain, how to maintain balance between becoming more at ease with discomfort and responding wisely. And then a question about just the comment that we've been living here without many of the conditions which give rise to dukkha, and without the distractions that we often use to cope with dukkha. As these more difficult conditions emerge, how might we cultivate a skillful use of distractions? So just generally about working with difficult situations. The standard instruction is not to go digging, not to go looking, not to go dredging things up, but just to wait until they arise. And sometimes, as I've said to many of you in the individual meetings, they naturally arise precisely because some part of our psyche has relaxed a little, and at the same time, our capacity to be with difficulty has increased. So trusting that organic process to some extent, just allowing that when the conditions are appropriate, whatever the next stage of challenging material can naturally come to be integrated, to be metabolized, to be digested. So that's the general suggestion. Having said that, there are times when recurrent thought patterns just keep coming and coming and coming and coming, and we're trying to just be with the breath, be with the breath, be with the breath, and we start to get into a struggle. So at that point, it might be more appropriate just to say, okay, let's take a session of meditation and get a sense of what is going on here. And so then dropping the attention out of the story, try not to reinforce the narrative at all, coming more into the heart, into the belly, and sensing in, perhaps, to some of those emotions that might be percolating just below the surface of the story and in some way feeding it. So then when we can connect contact with those emotions and memories and associations, bring them more fully into awareness and meet them with compassion. So we're not trying to force things to arise. That's the key point. Remembering when I talked earlier about working with difficult emotions, that we want to be orienting to staying to some extent within our window of tolerance so that we don't get slammed by really difficult stuff, but we can open to it metaphorically in bite-sized chunks so that we can digest, metabolize it. So sometimes people come on retreat with an agenda or a project. I am going to get through this or drill down into that or nuke such and such out of existence. Usually not so helpful. In fact, part of my role at IMS was helping people recover from having that kind of approach to their practice. So I'm really happy that all of you here have been staying in that middle way. So similarly, working with pain, you know, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, the question was how to maintain balance between becoming more at ease with discomfort and responding wisely. So even over the course of this retreat, I'm guessing most of you are experiencing a little bit less discomfort than you did on the first day. Is that true? Generally speaking?
Just physical.
Physical pain.
Sure.
Yeah, just because our bodies have got more used to sitting, being in this posture for longer. So there is that balance again between bearing with it, sensing into our capacity. But then if we find ourselves just getting tight, contracted, frustrated, not able to be with it, then the wise response is to take what we need to do to bring a little more ease. But in all of this, as I'll be saying probably several times, what we do is not as important as whether we're aware that we're doing it. So if we're sitting, realizing this is getting to an edge, okay, that's enough, literally or metaphorically, bow, change to standing, or perhaps go and do walking, that's fine. That's totally different than just sitting there, getting more and more tight, more and more frustrated, and then just bolting from the hall because it's so intense. So the wise response is just gently working that edge, working that balance. Can I be with this just another couple of seconds? Yeah. Wow, just released. Or, yeah, and now that's enough. Okay. So a little bit of restraint, not pushing, not resisting. And so then the third question in relation to difficult conditions is about cultivating a skillful use of distractions. So hard to know what the person means by distractions. If it's sinking a bottle of wine, maybe not so skillful. Not sure there's a skillful way to do that. But again, if there's that consciousness about what we're doing, then it's not necessarily a distraction. So we use this term skillful means. So if I'm dealing with, okay, conditions which give rise to dukkha, say we're just completely stressed out after a really terrible day at work, and we come home, we've got a pounding headache, really agitated, and so on, we might just consider what is needed right now. And what might be helpful right now is just to sit down and watch one episode of a comedy series, just to kind of reset. But again, if we're doing it with full awareness that we're doing it and why we're doing it, and then when we've done it, we look at the effect. To me, that's not a distraction. It's that term, skillful means. So in all of this, it's really how much awareness are we bringing to the choices that we're making? Are we just reinforcing greed, hatred, and delusion? Or are we bringing more clarity? And then noticing what's the effect of what I do. Does it support more ease or not? That's really the benchmark. Okay, so now on to the more positive aspects of meditation. Does the state of bliss and eventual dissolution in meditation practice have a further purpose other than strengthening my understanding of anicca and anatta, impermanence and not-self? So one of the challenges with written questions is that I can't know for sure what the person who wrote the question means by, quote, the state of bliss or, quote, eventual dissolution. Because both of these can be experienced at a whole range of different depths. But on their deepest level, they function to severely weaken and then to uproot entirely different afflictive states that are known as the fetters, so that those afflictive states don't come back again. So the experiences of bliss and dissolution are not an end in themselves, if that's what the questioner is asking. As the practice ripens and matures, they have the power to totally transform our understanding in ways that permanently change us for the better. So then there's a question about consciousness. As we use consciousness to observe what arises, how do we then think of it or work with it as an aspect of I have no I? So referring back to not self again. And in the framework of the clinging aggregates that I gave a couple of nights ago, consciousness is the last of these five aspects of experience that the Buddha named as being ones that we commonly cling to or identify with, and from them construct a fixed sense of self. And in these teachings, the sense of me is a kind of optical delusion of consciousness, which is how Albert Einstein referred to it. And that optical delusion arises from the coming together of certain conditions, namely the body, feeling tones, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And together these give rise to a sense that there's a me in here who's experiencing the universe out there. And we keep referring all our experience back to this sense of a permanent entity that's somewhere just inside us. But if we look for it, we can't find it. In any moment, what or where or how or who is this me that I believe myself to be? It's just a sense of I am-ness. And when we investigate that sense of I am-ness more closely, we understand it doesn't have any solid, fixed reality. So coming back to that question about consciousness, and perhaps the comment I made the other night about how consciousness is the last holdout of the self, perhaps if we use the term awareness instead of consciousness, then we might understand that there can be awareness without an awarer. Now that's not an actual English word, but hopefully you get the gist. There can be awareness without an awarer. And that's pointing to the emptiness of the functioning of awareness or consciousness. awareness or consciousness exists because of the interplay of all of the aggregates coming together. Having a body, having a functioning mind, having consciousness, together they give rise to that delusion of a fixed entity. But in actual reality, there's simply awareness without an awarer. Got it?
Yep.
It's dark in here, but I can see a few blank looks. Which is okay, you know, like I was emphasizing the other night. This is something we can only on a very limited level take in with our intellects. So just to share more of that quote by Albert Einstein, because in a way it points us towards the purpose of this understanding of anatta, of not-self, and that purpose being compassion. So this was written in the 1950s, so I've changed the language to be gender neutral, but this is what it says. A human being is a part of the whole, called by us universe. A part limited in time and space. One experiences oneself, one's thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of one's consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. Okay, so the next question is about one of the potential pitfalls of our Dharma journey. And it asks, can you please talk a little about spiritual bypass? So I can't remember whether I talked about this term during this retreat or whether the person heard it somewhere else. But anyway, just to give a bit of context, the term spiritual bypassing was developed in the 1980s by the Buddhist psychologist John Wellwood, who I just discovered died in 2019. And he described this in his book, Towards the Psychology of Awakening. He defines it like this. Spiritual bypassing is a term I coined to describe a process I saw happening in the Buddhist community I was in, and also in myself. Although most of us were sincerely trying to work on ourselves, I noticed a widespread tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. Meditation was also frequently used to avoid uncomfortable feelings and unresolved life situations. For those in denial about their personal feelings or wounds, meditation practice can reinforce a tendency towards coldness, disengagement, or interpersonal distance. They are at a loss when it comes to relating directly to their feelings or to expressing themselves personally in a transparent way. They can be quite threatening when those of us on a spiritual path have to face our woundedness or emotional dependency or primal need for love. So the coldness, the disengagement, the interpersonal distance that John Wellwood is describing there can come about from misunderstanding or misusing certain types of meditation practice. And from privileging meditation practice itself at the expense of all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So we didn't have time to go into the Noble Eightfold Path in detail on this retreat, but just to say that as I think most of you know, this path comprises not just meditation factors. Meditation factors of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise samadhi. But it includes factors that need to be developed in daily life too. Wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And all of the factors are guided by the first two, wise view and wise intention. So if we're consciously developing all of these eight factors together, that holistic approach to practice is what protects us from spiritual bypassing. Unfortunately, though, in the West, at least the way the Dharma first has come to the West, there's been an overvaluing of meditative factors and an undervaluing of the rest of the path factors, including the daily life ones, which are about looking at our ethics and how we relate to each other and ourselves. And so that's one reason why in my own teaching I bring in relational practices and also put more emphasis on the four Brahmavihara heart qualities to help guard against that potential to become disconnected or remote or superior. There's one aspect of practice, though, where this bypassing could show up, and that's in relation to the development of equanimity. So as I mentioned briefly, I think, each of the four Brahmavihara qualities has what is known as a near enemy and a far enemy. And these can come up when we're trying to cultivate the actual quality as obstacles that get in the way. So part of Brahmavihara practice is learning how to recognize these near and far enemies to help them release so we can cultivate the real thing. So the far enemy is the direct opposite of the quality that we're aiming for. So for example, the far enemy of metta, metta being goodwill, the far enemy is ill will, any form of aversion. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty, the motivation to cause harm rather than relieve it. The far enemy of mudita, or appreciative joy, is any form of resentment or envy or jealousy. And the far enemy of equanimity, the balanced heart-mind, is any form of reactivity, clinging or resisting anything. So those are the far enemies, and they're usually easier to recognize because they're generally experienced as pretty unpleasant, and they do feel to be pretty far from the quality that we're trying to develop. The near enemies, on the other hand, are a little harder to spot because they're sometimes experienced as quite pleasant, and because they are near, they might at first seem like they're the real thing. So for example, the near enemy of metta, of goodwill, is any form of conditional kindness. Kindness with an agenda, with strings attached. I'll be nice to you, so you'll be nice to me. Or I'll do this kind thing for you now, so that you'll help me out in the future. So remembering that all of the Brahmavihara are intended to be eventually completely unconditional, we want to be on the lookout for ways that metta might be just a bit tainted by some form of self-interest. Then the near enemy of compassion is pity, grief, despair, or overwhelm. And this can come up when we put too much emphasis on feeling with someone's pain or with our own pain. And we lose balance because we don't have the wisdom that supports clear seeing. And as a protection against this, as I mentioned the other day, we want to orient to the relief of whatever the pain is that we're dealing with. Even if it's just an imaginative exercise to help us not get bogged down in despair. And then the near enemy of mudita, appreciative joy, is giddiness, elation, ungrounded delight. And we can get attached to this state because it can be quite pleasant. and it gives us a momentary relief from misery. But eventually, because of impermanence, it will end. And sometimes we might need to turn towards equanimity to help to come back to balance more quickly. And then lastly, the near enemy of equanimity is any form of detachment, disconnection, disengagement, numbness. And these might come from suppressing our true feelings, especially ones we don't like, such as anger or shame. Or in some cases, depending on our conditioning, we might suppress our happiness and joy. So this is where spiritual bypassing has some potential to come in, as a form of false equanimity that's not based in genuine ease and acceptance. And we can misuse equanimity to convince ourselves that everything's fine, when in reality we're just disconnected or dissociated from what's actually happening in our inner life. And in my own practice, what helped me to distinguish between this false equanimity and the real thing is the body. The intellect can tell itself all kinds of stories and try to convince itself that they're true. But generally speaking, the body doesn't lie. So we can use the body as another source of information that, other than the intellect. And by tuning into the body, we can sense the energy that's present when we believe that we're being equanimous. And for me, one of the key differences is with true equanimity, there's a subtle vibration and warmth, an alive energy, and a quality of presence and attunement that's missing from the near enemy. So when I was disconnected and trying to pretend that it was equanimity, if I was honest and paid more careful attention, I could feel an underlying sense of flatness or coolness, numbness, dismissiveness. And that's different from true equanimity, which is a very refined form of responsiveness, which sees clearly what's going on and knows an appropriate response. So there's a wisdom to it. It's not deadness or disconnection or disengagement, but there is a stability to it, and that often feels quite different from the usual reactivity that we're more used to. So again, this is where this idea of getting used to it might come in. As we get used to not being so caught up in the dramas of our lives, and we learn how to more fully appreciate the middle ground of balance and ease, then equanimity flowers more fully. There's a lot here. Let's see. I think some of this we might have to save until tomorrow. Yeah. I'll just go to a related question, which was about Brahmavihara practice. And it's asking, could you give some practical examples of situations or circumstances, feelings, emotions, states, when you would, one, practice compassion, two, mudita, or three, equanimity? Okay, so one of the challenges of this being a relatively short retreat is there just isn't enough time to go into all of the different practices that I've been touching into here in more detail. And because this wasn't specifically a Brahmavihara retreat, I didn't give a whole lot of context or instruction about those practices. But if you go to Dharma Seed, you can find lots of talks that I've given on them, that plenty of other teachers have given on them. And if you email me, I can send you a link to some specific Brahmavihara retreat talks that I didn't make publicly available. So for now, just to give a few suggestions about when to practice with each of them. I think I may have mentioned in passing that The Brahmavihara work in two ways. One, they help to prevent afflictive states from coming up in the first place. And two, if those painful states do manage to get their hooks into us, they act as an antidote. So generally, it's a good idea to give ourselves a regular dose of each of them, sort of like multivitamins that strengthen our emotional immune system. And then, depending what else is happening in our lives, we might want to focus more closely on one of them in particular, whichever one feels most relevant to our circumstances. So as you know, compassion is what flowers when metta turns towards what's painful, difficult, challenging. And in my talk on the Two Wings to Awakening, I suggested working with compassion at times when some kind of painful situation or emotion has come up and our mindfulness or wisdom just isn't strong enough at that time to stay present with it. And we're getting reactive, resisting or feeding it. So when we realize that's happening, to help not be overwhelmed, we can bring in some self-compassion practice, gently acknowledging the pain, the distress, with that orientation to the wish to be free from it. So compassion is generally practiced to help relieve pain. But depending on circumstances, there may be times when coming closer to the pain feels too much, and we might be starting to slide into the near enemy of compassion, which is grief, despair, overwhelm. And at those times, it might be better to consciously go to mudita practice, appreciative joy, to tune into what's going well in our lives, what we can appreciate, and feel a sense of joy for. We can also experiment with mudita if we have a general tendency towards seeing the glass half empty, which, as I've been mentioning, is partly because of the brain's inbuilt negativity bias. So perhaps there are times when we're feeling a bit down, or perhaps the practice is feeling a bit stale or stuck. And then we might bring in some mudita practice just to see if that re-energizes it. And then equanimity is an antidote to all forms of reactivity. So it's kind of a universally applicable practice. And particularly when we might recognize some deep resistance to something, we could experiment with that phrase. May I open to how it is right now? Because this is how it is right now. And just see whether that has any effect on helping the resistance to release. So those are just a few suggestions for getting started with Brahmavihara practice. The key principle is really just to listen, to tune in to what's happening in your practice. And don't be afraid to experiment and to try things out. So all through this retreat, I've been emphasizing exploring and enjoying to help us get out of beliefs about right and wrong and good and bad practice. So I just really encourage you, particularly with the Brahmavihara practices, they can be very creative. And as I often joke, you know, it's pretty hard to accidentally develop too much metta. So feel free to go for it and just see what emerges. Okay, so the rest of the questions were about daily life practice. And there's quite a lot I could say there. At this point in the evening, I think I might just bring this part to a close, save some of those questions, try and squeeze them in somewhere tomorrow, and then just see if there are any further questions now from anything that I've just offered, if there's any clarifications that you would like. So, for now, thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.